You're listening to Crashing the Boards with Austin Johnson and Dave Popkin on Fox Sports Radio New Jersey. The guys are here to bring you the most comprehensive look at college basketball from Rutgers and Seton Hall to the national scene. Now, let's pass it off to our hosts. Dave and Austin, take it away.
Good morning and welcome to Crashing the Boards, along with Austin Johnson, Dave Popkin with you. We talk Rutgers, Seton Hall, all Garden State, hoops. We have a terrific show lined up for you today. Rider head coach Kevin Baggett will join us. They are on the move after a very slow start. Rider has it going and is back in contention in the MAC. So we'll talk with coach in a little bit. Also, Claude Johnson, one of our favorites, will join us. He is the founder of the Black Fives Foundation, and he wrote the book, The Black Fives, The Epic Story of Basketball's Forgotten Era. That book has won several awards. I really recommend it. And we have a nice long talk with Claude to talk about, black basketball pre-integration, first half of the 20th century. AJ, good to talk with you. And what's going on?
I'm well. Great to talk with you as well. And down to the final stretch of the regular season. And boy, has it been a tad turbulent, all things Rutgers considered calling the games. Obviously, the highs of the 4-game win streak now seem like a distant memory as they've now reeled off 3 losses in a row and trying to, figure out how to capitalize on, 4 remaining games that are winnable, starting with Michigan. And, then 2 consecutive road games at Nebraska and then at Wisconsin, who's also been struggling a bit, and then concluding the season with Ohio State coming to Jersey Mike's Arena.
At this point, Rutgers would probably have to win the Big Ten tournament to go to the big dance, but I think the NIT is still in play. They're not in the most recent NIT bracketology that I saw, 1 game over 500 coming into the Michigan game. But are people around Rutgers talking about that? Is that a goal? Is that a tournament you think they would even play in?
No, there's no chatter or noise, to at least that is elevated to me or has been brought to my attention. People are just figuring out how to focus in and try to win the next game. Each game, you still have to allocate a lot of energy. As you know, it's so difficult to win at this level. And if you start to overlook that, then you just start to make yourself even more vulnerable to potential losses. So locked in on the next game at hand has always been the mantra. And I'm sure that once the season concludes, if they've taken care of business, then that's when you start to entertain those conversations.
After the team won at Michigan, at Maryland, and then beat Wisconsin at home, hopes were high for the Scarlet Knights, but then you run into a tough stretch of the schedule. Northwestern seems like a tournament team. Minnesota on the bubble, it seems like they're, maybe a tournament team. Purdue, obviously, number one seed right now. Maryland was a desperate team. So it was kind of a tough stretch of schedule. But on the court, what was going wrong for Rutgers that they couldn't pull out a win there?
Just difficulty scoring has been a consistent theme. The defense still continues to be, the bell of the ball for what this program likes to hang its hat on. It's just, you got to also be able to marry that with the ability to put the ball in a basket and missing, makeable shots and missing, free throw opportunities and also some injuries, as of late with Moat Mag being in and out of the lineup. Minnesota was a really big opportunity, I think, to continue and get from 4 to 5. And then Purdue, essentially, you just run into teams that are angry. And Purdue was coming off of a loss, and they came out and left, no doubt, at Mackey, which is a really difficult environment. Maryland, Julian Reese had a really, really big-time game on the interior for the Terps from start to finish. I think the game planning was good for a lot of the guard play, but he was just a load. So Michigan is going to be really, really big, when these two teams match up. Rutgers beat Michigan in Ann Arbor earlier this year. You can imagine that this is a team that wants to get some revenge. But again, this is one of the, the worst performing teams in all the Big Ten and the Michigan Wolverines. You got to take advantage of these opportunities.
And then on the other side, Seton Hall seems like they're on the right side of the NCAA tournament bubble. Even after the loss at Creighton, which was dispiriting, their worst loss of the year, right up there with the Villanova game. They just couldn't handle Creighton's offense, their passing, their three-point shooting. It was a terrible night in Omaha, and then the team gets back at like, you know, 3-4 in the morning and has to regroup for UConn, which is actually coming up right after this show on the Seton Hall Radio Network. Gary Cohen will join me for the call of that one, a high noon start in stores. You want to talk about a difficult week at Creighton, at UConn. So Pirates had reeled off three in a row, five of their last six before the Creighton loss. People had them as a 10 or 11 seed. But this team still needs to win a couple games to stamp their ticket. They have Villanova at home, which is the game of the year. That's a game that they really need to have. And then DePaul is even more important because you can't lose that game against a team that hasn't won yet in the Big East. So things are very interesting for the Pirates right now.
Yeah, just emphasize again, you got to lock into the scout, to the tendencies, to the schemes of who is the team that's, you know, lining up against you. You can't start to look past any of that stuff because, you know, if you come in with the wrong type of approach and mentality, thinking that things are going to be a given, you know, that's when teams come out and jump all over you. It's so difficult to win at this level, as I always emphasize. And going to Creighton, just thinking about how important it is to obviously be relying upon your defense. And all, what are some of the other things that teams that went on the road always focus in on? The productivity of the bench. There wasn't really any of that for Seton Hall. And when your ace in the hole and Kadari Richmond goes out early with a couple of chippies, you got to be able to reallocate that pressure and that productivity other people. And unfortunately, just there just wasn't an answer for that call.
Richmond had an okay game with 15 points, but not a dominating game that Seton Hall needed. Isaiah Coleman and Sada Nganga, two of the bench guys, were back in South Orange with a non-COVID illness, so the team was kind of thin. Shaheen Holloway told me after the game that there were a couple of other guys that were not feeling well, but toughed it out and played anyway, and that he was proud of them, but they were not that competitive in the game. So we will see what happens coming up here today against UConn, a team that they beat by 15 points in Newark, one of only three losses for the defending national champion Huskies. Very interesting ball game. And then, you know, see if the Pirates can take care of business at home. If they can't beat Villanova, they'll have some work to do in the Big East tournament. They'll probably get, you know, a team like Nova or Providence in the first round there if they're in the 4-5 game. Let's take a timeout. When we come back, Riders Kevin Baggett, their head coach, will join us. Claude Johnson from the Black Fives. We'll also have some other thoughts on college basketball in the Garden State. Dave Popkin and Austin Johnson with you. This is Crashing the Boards on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey. Dave Popkin, Austin Johnson back with you. We're Crashing the Boards here on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey, and Fox Sports Radio, Jersey Shore. My guest now is the head coach of Rider in his 12th year, a former regular season champ, two-time MAC Coach of the Year, picked to win the league this year, and his team is coming on. They just knocked off first place Quinnipiac. It's Kevin Baggett. How are you, Coach?
I'm good, Dave. How are you?
Doing awesome. Let's start at the beginning of this season. Coaches thought you were going to have a good team, which is a compliment. You guys had a very difficult non-conference schedule. Can you take us through what you were fighting through early in the year to get to where you are now?
Yeah, I may have bit off a little bit more than I could chew, so to speak, when I put together this schedule. It was definitely the toughest schedule we played in the past 12 years. I thought we had a team returning that could compete against some of these high major schools that we schedule. Obviously, you know, at times we raise money for the university as well and the athletics. That was part of it. You know, and then I just believe in always playing a tough schedule and then hoping that'll help you down the stretch or when you get to league play. And I definitely believe that's what's going on now. But it was tough. Sometimes you don't take into account the guy's psyche sometimes. We were fragile as we continued to play these games night in and night out. And we had to rally guys. Plus the other thing too, we had eight new guys in addition to that. I don't know. I guess most people in the league were picky because you had a lot of returning guys, but a lot of these guys were playing in different roles. Corey McKeithen was not the starting point guard last year. I had a first team all conference point guard in Dwight Murray. You know, Mervyn James wasn't called upon as much as he's being called upon now. Alan Powell was in a little bit of a different role and not the guy that, you know, we were counting on night in and night out. He was a great piece. And now he's a huge piece of the puzzle. So it had to, guys had to accept their roles. They had to adjust and adapt to their new roles. And then we had five freshmen, which was a little bit of a mistake, too many freshmen. And normally I don't count on freshmen. And then, you know, some portal guys, some transfers, trying to bring eight new guys aboard. And, you know, it really takes a good while to learn all of our details. I'm a very detail-oriented coach, especially on the defensive end. So it took guys a little bit of while or time to learn all of those nuances and things. And I thought they were thinking more than they were playing. So once we were able to get everybody on board, understanding their roles, what their values are in the role, and just all the particulars that we asked them to do night in and night out, on top of practicing the right way, that's the most important thing. And that's what's got us here at this point.
You guys have won four games in a row entering this weekend. What in particular has been working well for you lately?
Well, the big thing, start on the defensive end. I think our guys are really locked in and dialed in on the defensive end, what it is that we want to do against our opponents, some of their tendencies, you know, from the scouting on individuals or what it is that we do night in and night out on a continuous basis, you know, defensively. We've really been sharing the ball really well. That was my biggest cry of late, sharing the ball, you know, four passes or more. You can get any shot that you want. Sometimes in this generation that we coach in now, I think guys struggle with that and they want to do more one-on-one things, but this basketball is still a team sport. And I think the more you can share the ball, the more guys touch the ball in the right places at the right time, I think you get good action and good shots out of that. And I think that's been the biggest thing for us. And just guys dialed in and bought in. I mean, sometimes it just takes a while for guys to understand, you know, just buying in, what it means to buy in. It's, the word buy-in is easy to say, but it's hard to do.
Having a sound strategy is one component of a season, but having the guys to go out there and execute is another. When you think about the progression of Mervyn and Tariq over the season, what have you seen in starting with Mervyn's game as the season has progressed?
Yeah, the biggest thing for Mervyn was the neat thing is he's come back to get his degree, first and foremost. So I want to mention that. Mervyn had an opportunity to go play professional after last year. And I just thought there were things that, you know, holes in his game, not big holes, but holes in his game that I thought he could get better at. Playing and shooting the ball better on the perimeter. He's always been a great mid-range player. Just IQ, raising his level of IQ and understanding watching film and how guys and teams are guarding him. And just the biggest role for him is being a leader. He's never been counted on to be a leader in high school and even here at Ryder and even at North Alabama. He wasn't called on or put in that role, and now he's in that role. And it's funny, he used to call Dwight Murray every day and say, man, I don't know how you did it, but this role here, this leadership stuff is tough. And, you know, our guys lean on him. They go as Mervyn goes. And he's just been a great extension of myself, of our coaches. And I think he's enjoying it. I think at one time he got frustrated when we weren't winning. But I just say, hey, Mervyn, here's where we are. But I need the best version of you, Mervyn. And if I can get that, then I can get the best version of everybody else. He said, Coach, I got you. I'll continue to do what I've been doing and even raise it up a notch. And that's what he's done. And then with Tariq Ingram, I don't think people understand the first 2 years at Wake Forest, he never really played. He tore his Achilles. He had a little bit of a heart issue. It wasn't anything serious, but at that time during the pandemic, nobody was dealing really with any kind of heart issues because we watched the young man at Florida pass out and have to be resurrected. And so, you know, that was very sensitive. And so, so now Tariq played last year, which was his first year. But we had a Jiri Ogoyumo, you know, who was been in our program. We really leaned heavily on him. Although Tariq, you know, started, he knew that, you know, Jiri was that guy. And so now when he's being counted on, he's in this new role, it took him a minute. You know, it took him another minute really to say, okay, I'm the post guy here. Everything's going to go through me in the post and in the paint. And I think he just needed to adjust. And the biggest thing for him was just ball screen defense. He was struggling with that, you know, and he's a big guy. And laterally, you know, it takes some time to get him up and going. And, you know, teams were setting a lot of ball screens and he struggled with it early. And finally, we figured it out with him, what he was most comfortable with. And he started to thrive from there because he stopped thinking and he stopped fouling. He was able to stay in the game. And, you know, he's a presence. And when him and Mervin are playing well, you know, right, the Ryder Bronx are playing well. They're not, we're struggling. And so we go as those two go.
You've coached a lot of successful players and successful teams. And I know you probably know better than anybody. It's really good to be playing your best basketball in the right point in the season. How do you get your guys to buy into that mantra when you're suffering your lumps, you know, early on in the season?
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough to get guys to understand. I kept saying to these guys, like, fellas, we're a really good team. You know, we lost a couple of games that, you know, could have gone either way. And when you're struggling, that ball doesn't bounce your way. We had to make things happen and guys needed to get in the gym more. I don't think people understand, like, yes, you're in there to go to school, but the other half of that is to get on the basketball court and it's just not with the coaches. You got to get in there and get extra work up. And I think once the guys started to see them having success, not only Tariq and Mervin and Alan Powell and Corey and the rest of the guys started to say, wait a minute, I see what they're doing. And then the older guys started saying, hey, you guys got to get in the gym with us. And they started holding everybody accountable. And again, man, that's not even coaching. It's just a matter of having good leaders and leadership in terms of guys understanding, like, if you want to be successful, we could put you in place, but it's ultimately up to you all to buy into it and do it and go out there and execute it and get in and get the extra work in. And, you know, once you start to see some success, that success breeds it on everybody else. And that's exactly what's going on of late.
Conference tournament in Atlantic City is going to be wild this year for the MAC. Kevin Baggett, the head coach of Ryder, is with us here on Crashing the Boards. And if you can figure out what's going to happen in AC, you're a better man than me, because Iona has come back to earth. St. Peter's was near the top, and then they slid, and then Washington came back, and they're playing well again. So Fairfield's played great lately. I think it's anybody's game, right?
It is. It is. And that's every year. You know, it's almost scary to be the first place team a lot of times, because in our league, that first place hasn't won it as often. But again, you want to be playing your best basketball. This league has been that league where I've been in it 18 years. I've seen, you know, last year, Merce was the last place team. Next thing you know, they're in the championship. It is about matchups. It's about peaking at the right time. It's about going in and, you know, you need a team. It's not going to be individuals that's going to win this for you, this tournament. It's going to be a team play offensively, defensively, because some teams might have to play 3 days in a row. A team or two might have to play 4 games in a row. So your guess is as good as mine, because I think anybody in this league can come out and be the MAC champions.
Just looking at your career in particular, who were your coaching influences, either maybe somebody you played for, somebody you coached under, or maybe just watched from afar that kind of melded and helped you?
So coming up, it was my high school coach, Ken Faulkner. We won a state championship. He was a mentor, not having had a father. A white man came into my life and my family's life. I have an older brother that played as well. And today, if you can trust me, and let me put you guys in position, I think we can help you get to where it is you need to get to. That took some convincing of my mom to, you know, very protective of her kids. It started with him. It started with a man. You know, it always takes just one person to believe in you. So it started right there with Ken Faulkner. We went on to win, you know, a state championship, 31-0 in South Jersey. So that kind of started my career. Then I ended up going to St. Joe's. But I had a mentor in Brian Warwick that played at St. Joe's, and Brian went on to play in the NBA for a long time. That was my mentor, the guy that grew up in my hometown, a guy that I kind of patterned myself after as a player. And then, you know, the different coaches that I've coached for, the Frankie Allens when I was at Howard. Dennis Felton was another guy at Western Kentucky who's now over at where is Dennis now? At Providence. And, another guy, but I've learned so much. I've been to 6 different schools. Tommy Dempsey was another one that really believed in me. Don Harnum, our athletic director, when I got the Ryder, and spent my first 6 years as the assistant. I learned so much under Tommy, and he was preparing me to be a head coach. And it was through Don that, you know, that trusted me and that seen me for those 6 years to be able to say, hey, I like something in you. I've seen you for 6 years. And just giving me that opportunity. I tell people all the time, I had different opportunities to go, but my athletic director, Don Harnum, said, hey, if you embody yourself here and you, you know, if you just stay here and ground yourself here, some opportunities might present themselves at some point. And that's what happened. And, you know, I've been blessed, man. It's hard to be a head coach for this long and this long of a tenure. And so I don't take anything for granted. I've had a lot of great players that come through to help us. And just a lot of great people that are around me, my great staffs, our administration, our president. And, you know, it takes a village to really help you to be able to be successful. And I don't get there by myself. So I'm thankful for all the folks that have been in my life. My mentors when I was coming up, you know, we were some of my, myself and a couple of my friends were what they called untouchables. No, no drugs, no alcohol. These guys got, they've got somewhere they're going to be going. And so we had people that always looked out for us. I've been blessed to just be in the right place at the right time. And I thank God for that.
Coach, a lot of success with Jason Thompson coming back and being a really big influence from a coaching standpoint. But you talked about the longevity, and part of that is building a successful program. I played with the Mansells in high school and always heard great things about Ryder. How important is it to have that alumni influence to continue to pay it forward for the younger generation?
Awesome. Speaking of Mansells, Harris was just at our game on Sunday. It's funny, man. He's with his wife and two kids. Just those are things are, that are rewarding to you as a coach as you watch and see your guys go on and have success in the real world, the working world, the basketball world, like Jason Thompson and guys having families. And that's the blessing of it because, you know, this coaching gets hard at times. You know, sometimes kids don't want to listen. Sometimes you can't save every young man. And but when you see the guys like Jason Harris and those guys, the success they have, and then watching Jason, you know, from college, from high school to college, and then to go on the pro, to play in the pros and watch what he did, you know, overseas and everything, and come back and contribute and donate to the university. And then he and I have had those conversations forever about, hey, once you're done, if this is something you want to do, love to have you back. And what better way to have somebody in your program that went through all the channels of being a student athlete at the university, a spokesman at the university, and then to come back and be able to tell our guys, here's the blueprint. I can't tell it because I never played in the NBA. He has the blueprint. And if you really want to be successful, listen to him. Be a sponge. Follow him. I know it's hard to get to the NBA, but we got a number of guys playing overseas professionally. We've had some guys have cups of coffee in the NBA and what have you. So we have the blueprint if they would just listen, which they do. And I got a guy on my bench that been there and done all of that. So, again, that's a blessing to have him. And he's been a big part of us turning it around with our bigs, with Tariq and all the other big guys. And just as he's very infectious, man. He's funny all the time. He's young. You know, we get old, so we – start talking about when we were playing. Those guys don't want to hear that, you know? So Jay just is a year or two removed from playing. And so they can relate to Jay more at that time than they can us. And he's just been awesome, man. He has a great way about him. He's going to go on and be a great head coach someday. And, you know, some of my other coaches as well, they're going to go on and get their own jobs. It's been awesome, man, to have alums that are everything. All of our players, I talked to them all the time, guys overseas. That's what it's about, man, the alums and former players that come back and bridge the gap between the current and the past players. That's the neatest thing for me.
Ryder Bronx have their mojo working again. They're going to be dangerous down the stretch. We will follow them into the MAC tournament and perhaps beyond. Kevin Baggett, thanks for joining us.
Fellas, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coach, thank you. Take a time out. Be back with more on Crashing the Boards in a moment here on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey. This is Crashing the Boards on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey and Jersey Shore. Dave Popkin, Austin Johnson with you. And we're thrilled to welcome a guest onto the program who is an author, an historian, an engineer, a swag maven, and certainly a gentleman that I love talking to always. His book, the award-winning book, The Black Fives, the epic story of basketball's forgotten era. He's preserving pre-NBA history of African Americans in basketball. It's Claude Johnson. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing? Really great to be on here. Nice to see you again, Dave, and also Austin as well. It's an honor and a pleasure.
I always like talking to you because I learn so much. I think that fans still don't really have an appreciation or knowledge of how much basketball was being played in the Black community pre-integration. There's so much written and so much video even of baseball, Negro League baseball and barnstorming baseball and Satchel Paige and all that stuff. But basketball was kind of forgotten. How long have you been on this quest to kind of publicize this and teach people about it?
Well, thank you. Yeah, so I've been doing this since about 1996. That's when I was working at the NBA, actually. I was in there, the director of international licensing for them. And that was the year they celebrated what they called their 50th anniversary. They published a book. I have it here somewhere. It's an 800-page book called the NBA Encyclopedia of Basketball. But it only included three pages devoted to earlier African-American teams. Those two teams were the New York Rens and the Harlem Globetrotters, who were really from Chicago. I knew that there were more because I had picked up Arthur Ashe's book, the tennis legend, A Hard Road to Glory. And in that book, he listed maybe a dozen teams. And I was living in Brooklyn at the time. And one of those teams was the Smart Set Athletic Club of Brooklyn. And so I'm sitting there thinking, okay, wait, I'm smart. I'm athletic. I live in Brooklyn. That would have been my club. And it was an all-Black social and athletic club that was formed in 1904. So I'm thinking, how do we not know about this? And not only just sports fans, but the general population. So I'm walking down Flatbush Avenue and I'm thinking to myself, since I'm in licensing, man, that would be a cool t-shirt, right? Smart Set Athletic Club. And I'm walking down Brooklyn, you know, and so that was the original thought. And it just kind of started me on this quest of, okay, wait, where are these other teams? How did, Mr. Ashe even find out about these teams? What is research? How do you even do research? I didn't even know. Slowly, I began to learn that you have to go to the library. You have to go to, you know, the Schomburg and look in the basement, and there were microfilm machines and readers, and you had to scroll through them. None of this was digitized because it was like late 90s. So I spent, you know, my weekends, holidays, whatever, anytime I could, vacation time down there, and eventually learned that there were dozens of all-Black teams that played, you know, starting from about 1904 through all the way through to 1950 when the NBA signed their first Black players. And so it's been kind of at it ever since.
New York Rens celebrating their 100th anniversary season. They had 88 straight wins in the 1933-34 season, about 10 years after they started one of the dominant teams on the scene. In a nutshell, for people that don't know about the Rens, what was that team about?
Yeah, so they were formed in 1923. So this year we're really celebrating the 1923-24 season, which is the 100th season since they were formed. And they folded, you know, they dissolved in 1949. Between that time, they played about 125 games a season, and they won about 85%. Which is like an NBA team winning 70 games a season for 25 years in a row. But yet, there's nothing in the world almost to show that this team even existed in New York City or anywhere else where they played, you know, because they barnstormed in everywhere, New Jersey, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, all over the place, including in the South. You know, so what we're trying to do with our organization, the Black Fives Foundation, is to give proper recognition to not only the Rens, but all the other teams. One of the things that we're doing now with a fundraising campaign, you know, we have a court repainting that we're doing in Harlem. And then we're also doing, you know, a walk of fame on the sidewalk to where that team played in Harlem. And then also a commemorative bench with a historical marker so people can kind of sit there and contemplate what this history was all about. So those are the kind of projects that we're doing, and the Rens were certainly amazing in that regard.
Owl Field Club is a shirt that I'm wearing right now. They played in Newark at Morris Park. And I know that there were other New Jersey teams in the Black Fives era. What were some of the highlights of Black basketball in New Jersey, like in the first half of the 20th century?
There were always teams right from the very beginning. The Jersey City Athletic Club was an all-Black team that played really even before 1910. And then they also had the Owl Field Club, which you're wearing that T-shirt. They were based out of Newark. There was actually the Atlantic City Athletic Club, which was based in Atlantic City, and they were popular. And the reason why some of these teams existed, most of them were amateur clubs or semi-pro. Montclair YMCA actually had a pretty strong team at the time. People don't realize that there were all Black YMCAs back then, it was just to give everybody a chance. You know, the YMCA, to its credit, it said, okay, but we actually want people to have YMCAs, even if they're called colored branches, right? And the thing about it is, you know, it started off slow, but then people started realizing, wait a minute, you know, we can make money. We can have you know, orchestras or bands here, you know, that were playing ragtime or dance music. So a lot of the early advertisements would say basketball and dance. And that's because there was literally a live orchestra that played before the game and then during halftime and then after the game. And then there was a dance, because then it became a social event. And it was meaningful because, you know, the Black community was in transit. People were coming from the South to the North. There was overcrowding. There was no way to really communicate and talk other than if you went to an event like this. Most people didn't have phones, and a lot of people didn't have, you know, obviously nobody had, you know, social media, but that was really the first social networking opportunities in sports.
Inspiring excellence by preserving, teaching, and honoring the history of African Americans in basketball is obviously quintessential to what you want to do. But can you talk a little bit about how important it's been to adapt to modern day, vehicles such as name, image, and likeness to be able to continue that messaging? And then more specifically, how important it was to partner with a star player like Kamora Arnold from UConn?
If we're talking about modern day sports and name, image, likeness, NIL, which is the right of a player to be paid regardless of what they're doing. And, you know, that for people who don't realize it, an NCAA player never used to be able to earn money outside of really in any way, because they didn't want that player to be influenced by money. And this goes all the way back to the invention of basketball, where Luther Gulick was very outspoken about mixing money and sport. He thought that that all sport would, but especially basketball, would get ruined by money. And so for, you know, the first decade or so that Black basketball teams existed, there was a strong push against any kind of professionalism, because the Black community was trying its best to get the approval of the Victorian era rules and authorities who were, you know, kind of controlling the game. They were looking around and they said, okay, but everybody else is making money at this. Everybody else is doing it. So we might as well try it as well. And there was a little bit of a pushback, but eventually there were at least semi-pro teams that were getting paid to play. But there was this one individual, Will Anthony Madden, and he's actually on the cover of my book. He's a gentleman, if you have the book in front of you, wearing the carnation and the high collar shirt. Right. And he, in 1920, wrote an essay called The Future of Basketball. And it's profound because this is more than 100 years ago, but he predicted that there's no way to keep professionalism and amateurism separate, because the public wants to see the best quality of basketball. So in order to get the best quality of basketball, you have to have the best players. And in order to get the best players, you've got to pay them, because there's no way they can stay in that realm of just college sports. And so the best players were eventually going to gravitate towards where the money was, because people are trying to make a living. And he predicted this like to the T. In 1920, the NCAA and the AAU and all the the different manipulations that they've done over the last century eventually got washed away to where now players can get recognized for who's making the money, right? Because at the end of the day, there's too much of a gap between those making the money and those who are providing the content, providing the actual product. But to add a twist to it, in terms of KK Arnold, who is a freshman at the University of Connecticut in the Big East, which is the dopest basketball conference in college sports, you know, the thing about it is about 5 years ago, we got this email from a freshman high school student, and it said, you know, can we please get some help because I'm trying to create this presentation for a school project. And so it was like, we sent some things or whatever, and she created this project, which ended up getting some kind of regional recognition. And then she posted something on Twitter about the presentation. And I thought, wow, this is the best presentation I've ever seen. And it really was amazing. It's, you know, I still have not seen a better one. She had all the different aspects of the sport and the history laid out. And then I was like, okay, let me see what else is on her feed, her Twitter feed. And I scroll down and I'm like, wait, what? She looks like a combination of Michael Jordan, James Worthy, and I don't know who else, like Magic Johnson, like all in one, like just dominating on the court. As a freshman, she already won the state championship and had already been named, you know, like Wisconsin State Player of the Year. And then I just kept following her. And then she started winning, you know, gold medals and Junior Olympics and more, McDonald's All-American and all this stuff. And what people don't realize is when she was a little girl, she had UConn posters in her room. And she always dreamed of wanting to go to UConn. So like, I got to know her mom and dad and her family, you know, and then we start sending them like, you know, maybe a t-shirt or some swag or whatever. And I didn't realize like where this was going to go. But then one day I said, okay, wait, there's NIL, but there's no, as far as we know, there's no nonprofit that focuses on education and let's say leadership that has signed an NIL deal with somebody, you know, like usually it's a sneaker or, you know, you get a car or whatever, hotel, whatever the different brands are. And so we thought, well, why not make this something that's unique and different? And it speaks to the thought leadership of the Big East Conference as a whole, you know, all the 11 member institutions, and just have, you know, an education and leadership NIL ambassador deal, you know. And KK is perfect because she's a freshman. She's already starting and playing and making huge contributions. She's been freshman of the week, you know, several times. I think she was named as a preseason freshman of the year. And so, you know, we'll see what happens next. But we're just super delighted that she could represent us in that way.
Speaking of swag that you just alluded to, the Black Five swag is elite. And looking at the shop, it seems as though you have it down to a creative tee. What's that process like of balancing out, preserving and honoring the past, but having your own creative twist on anything that you bring to market?
Yeah, you know, early on when I first started doing this, because I eventually left the NBA and went to Nike from the league. And then after that, I worked at some other, you know, streetwear clothing companies and in the sports industry, and started learning about product and, you know, how people build product, and then also the meaning of product. And so in the community of not only sports fans, but also just culture, a lot of times what we wear is kind of like a language of its own. You know, when I see Dave wearing, you know, Isle Field Club, it tells me something about him. And then he's telling me something back, and how I react to that tells him something about me. And so then I'm like, oh, that's a dope t-shirt. And then already like we have a connection. And what is that t-shirt? I've never seen that. What is that? Tell me more. And it starts a conversation. So to us, it's really like a language of its own. You know, to have an opportunity to create product and to have partners, you know, that like Puma and Lids and the Big East and others, you know, who now Ebbets Field Flannels, you know, it just puts more out there, more conversations, more opportunities to, you know, to start a dialogue and to get this out there. But we can't obviously do only that. We also value the conversations that we've been able to have with Big East athletes, men's and women's teams, and all the administrators and athletic directors and coaches. And just we have to keep going, because it's not enough just to have a bunch of product. You know, we're trying to really have that be meaningful in and of itself, so that it creates some kind of action. You know, and that's why we shifted our mission statement slightly to include that we're inspiring excellence. Because at the end of the day, you have to use all this history, and our slogan is "Make History Now," because it's not only making it relevant today, but also what does that mean in terms of this moment and all the things that happen in this moment, which is essentially, you know, everything, right? Whether you're practicing free throws or doing that last rep, doing that last set, or whatever the case might be. So it's a lot, but we're also trying to build our team and in all these other different areas right now.
Claude Johnson is with us here, the author of the award-winning book, The Black Fives, and the head of the Black Fives Foundation. I could literally go hours with you on all of this stuff. My last question is, in terms of college basketball, pro basketball, like, what was the timeline and who was ahead of who in terms of integrating and getting Black players into, like, mainstream leagues and basketball?
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, there were, you know, all Black teams, and they routinely played against all white teams, even before 1910. This is what people don't realize is like, there's this myth that somehow there was a secret game or something, but the reality is teams played against one another, you know, from way back at the inception. And, but there wasn't any integration, unless you count a couple of unusual exceptions that were made, you know, during the 1910s, actually, by Will Anthony Madden and others, where they had a Jewish player on their team or two Jewish players on their team, which was otherwise an all-Black team. And you can read about it in the book because it's fascinating. There weren't really mixed teams in professional sports until really the 1930s with the National Basketball League. Then you had the Basketball Association of America that was formed in 1946. Now, what's interesting is the NBA doesn't recognize the National Basketball League, which means they don't recognize all this previous history of racial integration in the National Basketball League, including about 15 Black superstar players, some of whom ended up playing on teams that are now NBA teams. So it's kind of like cutting off your family tree for marketing reasons. Eventually they'll have to reconcile all that. But, you know, that's when the real racial integration started happening, is after the NBA opened the doors for Black players in 1950. The conferences were a bit behind with that. You know, Big Ten, SEC, obviously, and others. But by then, you had the HBCU, Historically Black Colleges and University Conferences, that also started to develop basketball teams and their own you know, championship tournaments and whatnot. You know, so really that all started in the late 50s and then into the 60s.
Claude, I really appreciate all the time today. We enjoyed it. And if folks want to get involved, it's blackfives.org. Ways to donate to the Wrens project, correct?
Yes. Yeah. You can go to our website and there'll be a banner there, and you can give or shop or just learn and share whatever you've learned. But I'd like to ask your viewers to pledge to tell five people more about whatever they learned that was new. And then that spreads the word. So Black Fives, you know, tell five, tell your niece, tell your cousin, tell your bro, tell your teammate. And this way we'll keep spreading this history.
Absolutely. We appreciate it. I'll see you on the road in the Big East. I know that's been a great ongoing association for you and a way to publicize all of this terrific history. Claude, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Austin.
It's Claude Johnson from Black Fives Foundation joining us here on Crashing the Boards. Take a time out, be back with some final thoughts here on Fox Sports Radio New Jersey. Along with Austin Johnson, Dave Popkin with you. We're on Crashing the Boards here on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey, talking Garden State hoops. You can also follow us as an archived podcast on foxsportsradionewjersey.com. What a show. Kevin Baggett turned it around at Ryder. It looked like that team was in the tank, and they are a threat right now. And Seton Hall and Rutgers, obviously, we talked about both still in the mix for postseason play. And Claude Johnson, I mean, he just inspires me so much to learn more about the history of the game.
Yeah, Coach Baggett, you could see the experience coming through in this juncture of the year. Been there, done that is the vibes that you get based off of some of his feedback. And it's nice to have veteran leadership to be able to right the ship when you go through a little bit of adversity. Rutgers and Seton Hall, obviously huge, you know, 4 to 5 games remaining in regards to what that could mean for postseason implications. So I'll be locked in. And what a phenomenal message when we talk about the importance of honoring the past and not forgetting and finding new ways to continue to accentuate that message, you know, through modern vehicles. So really enjoyed that conversation about the Black Fives as well. What a show.
I bet you got the credit card out, right? You're going to blackfives.org. That's some cool stuff on there.
I need your promo code, man. I need, you got all the swag over there. You got to let me know how to get it 50% off.
People can go to blackfives.org to learn about what we're talking about. There's a lot of great gear on there. And all these New Jersey teams are still in the mix. Princeton steamrolling toward the Ivy League tournament. NEC, the MAC, wide open for FDU and St. Peter's, Monmouth, NJIT. These teams have a puncher's chance right now to try to make the big dance. All right, AJ, we will talk to you next week. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. See you soon. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We thank our production team, our head coach, Mike Cohen, Jack Myatt, Alexander the Great, Alex Garrett. For everybody, I'm Dave Popkin. We will see you out at the courts. This has been Crashing the Boards on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey.
You've been listening to Crashing the Boards on Fox Sports Radio, New Jersey. Austin and Dave will be back next week with some great scoops for your college hoops, only on 93.5 FM, 1450 AM, Fox Sports New Jersey.